Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Episode number 164, if you can believe it, of the Course Grinding Podcast with you as always this evening, host creator Sean Rossler. How's everyone doing this fabulous Mother's Day? Happy Mother's Day to all of you mothers, be they cat mothers, dog mothers, kid mothers. I'm jealous of the only cat mothers because kids are horrible, as my guest will attest to my couple of texts with, hang on, I'm parenting. Anyway, just a quick tip of the hat there to everybody in that mother category. Hope you enjoyed your day. You know, I think there comes a point in time, whether or not it's from COVID-induced psychosis, who's to say, where you become so familiar with your surroundings that you think you've seen it all. You believe deep in your heart and soul that there's really nothing more to be seen, and that's honestly a kind of awful feeling, almost limiting. So imagine my surprise a few weeks past as I was doing a virtual presentation, lecture, demo, whatever you want to call it, on upskilling and reskilling, of all things, all centered around the art of making an omelet. So imagine my surprise when a former student of mine, now colleague, congratulations, was in the audience and reminded me of what she does and how we just never connected to do the show. Well, do the show we shall, and it's an educational one for sure. Few words strike awe in the culinary landscape like Wagyu. Wagyu, a Japanese beef cattle breed derived from native Asian cattle. Wagyu refers to all Japanese beef cattle, where wa means Japanese and gyu means cow. Wagyu were originally draft animals used in agriculture and were selected for their physical endurance. Riveting. Trust me, this is going somewhere, folks. This selection favored animals with more intramuscular fat cells, marbling as it were, which provided a readily available energy source. Wagyu is a horned breed and the cattle are either black or red in color. Wagyu cattle were first imported in 1975 when two black and two red bulls were imported by Morris Whitney. In 1989, the Japanese began to reduce their tariffs on imported beef, and that encouraged U.S. producers to produce a high-quality product for Japan. In the 1990s, there were several importations of quality Wagyu. Most were black, but a few were red Wagyu. These cattle have the greatest influence on the U.S. herd and those in many other countries. Now, my Google research aside, let's fast forward to today, where the Wagyu breed has a vital role to play in the U.S. to increase the quality of red meat produced in the U.S. that our health-conscious consumer of the 21st century is forever seeking. And listen, this is where the world gets weird, because I had the owner of a Wagyu farm in my class. How lucky was I? And finally, through fate perhaps itself, I've got her here with us this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, and everyone in between, fifth generation owner-operator of Greenwood Valley Wagyu, a Wagyu beef farmer, and my former student to boot, Ms. Lindsay Miller. What is going on, Lindsay?
Thank you for inviting me to be part of this podcast. I'm really excited.
Of course.
Doing well tonight. Good. I do have one question, though, for you.
Yes.
Does being a cow mother count for Mother's Day?
Because
if so, then I fall in that category.
Abso-freaking-lutely. I'm telling you, I don't care if you got a pet rock, man. And, you know, you feel that? You feel it. It's real. I love it. So, cow moms included, absolutely no question. It's so crazy for me, Wagyu being what it is, you know, being this, like, it goes beyond Cadillac. I almost start to say Cadillac, but it goes far beyond that, you know, in this mm-hmm. field. And how random life can be sometimes, because not only were you in that class that I was teaching at Bloom, but it was additionally a multimedia class where we talked about podcasting. So, like, mm-hmm. two weird layers come together to form the serendipity where you're watching my clown ass flip omelets and talk about upskilling with Dr. DeFelice, and here we are tonight. So, I'm so stoked to learn about the breed, about the quality, and just like mm-hmm. I always had it in my head, dumb as it is, that this was some kind of faraway thing. Even though I knew there was American Wagyu, I didn't think it was local. So, like, I'm so stoked to get into it. So, again, thank you so much for carving out time out of what I know is a busy schedule to hang out here with us this evening. Folks new to the show, folks with terrible short-term memories like mine, We're going to be three sections deep in the interview, starters, mains, and afters. Starters, we're going to talk about where the guest this evening hails from, comes from, what brought them to where they're at and what they're doing today, whereas the mains is exactly what they're doing today. And finally, the afters are a little bit more irreverent, a little bit more off the cuff, but no one has been seriously bodily injured in 163 episodes, so I don't see it happening tonight, especially with someone who works around these big-ass animals that could literally kill by looking at you wrong. So without further ado, Lindsay Miller, talk to me about where and what you grew up eating.
So I grew up in Chester County, Spring City, Pennsylvania, to be exact, about 45 minutes outside of Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And growing up in farming, we had a lot of beef in our household. Mm-hmm. More times than not, the beef we were eating was beef that we raised or somebody we knew closely raised. So we knew where it came from. We knew how it was handled. We knew what it was fed. Yeah. So it was definitely close to home for us. Yeah. And it was something that our family was just used to. It was a way of life for us.
Sure. For sure. And I'm going to ask something that I know, like I personally know the answer for, but I love to ask folks like you, who I know are going to have a deep, rich answer that I can't provide. Why is it so significant to know, and I'm going to focus right now on beef. Why is it so important to know where your beef comes from? Why should that mean something to the consumer?
Personally, I think, if you know where your beef comes from, more times than not, you're going to be supporting somebody local, mm-hmm. whether it be somebody you know directly or somebody that lives down the street from you or the next town over from you. But it's somebody that's part of your community who mm-hmm. has a commitment, and I'll say probably even stronger than a commitment, has a passion for working with the animal. And in this case, it's our cattle. They're part of our family. Mm-hmm. We treat them with respect. They, for lack of a better word, they're our pets. We mm-hmm. wake up in the morning thinking about them. We go to bed at night thinking about them. And we put our heart and soul into making sure that they're well taken care of, so that whatever their purpose may be down the road, that we get there in a smooth, clear path. And when you are buying a product that type of dedication goes into, you know that what you're consuming mm-hmm. is top quality. Compared to if you're just going to the grocery store and picking a pack of beef off the shelf, you don't know necessarily where it came from, who raised the animals, what went into the production. Yeah. But when it's somebody that's in your community, mm-hmm. you have direct access to them. You can ask them questions. If you ask any farmer, I have never known anybody to turn away a consumer from coming to actually see the property, see the animals, ask yeah. questions. It's just mm-hmm. a lot more hands-on, and there's a much more personal connection.
That's incredible. Yeah. And I mean, I kind of felt that, you know, certainly more eloquent and deeper than I could possibly go. But, you know, it's that matter of what kind of marriage do you want? You date for 3 years mm-hmm. and really know the person, or do you want some 90-day fiancé bullshit that you
exactly.
go to? Yeah, that's exactly what, not to glean off TLC, but my wife's been on a tear on it lately. So there you go. So not to get away from your backstory, because I want to know where, you know, you came from and how you got into this. You know, obviously mm-hmm. this is food centric. Were you a picky eater growing up?
Yes, I was a very picky eater growing up.
What was your absolute poison, bane of your existence? What would you not touch?
Oh, gosh. If it wasn't something like beef or chicken or French fries, I wasn't going anywhere near it.
No way. Wow. No. That's awesome, though. Like, I'm not going to lie. That's not a bad diet to stay to. I don't know, you know, how sustainable it is for how long, I'll be honest. But you know what? If I'm going to go, that's how I want to go. You know, looking back and obviously being in farming, I imagine food was central to your existence in some way, shape, or form, and cooking probably took kind of a central role. Tell me about where cooking fit in growing up and if there's foods that you miss from your childhood.
Yeah, so growing up, I feel like I probably grew up in a more unique situation than some other families. My grandmother lived on the other side of our house. So it was an old farmhouse, split sides. We lived on one side, and it was my brother, my dad, my sister, and myself. And then on the other side was my grandma and my grandpa. Every day at 5 o'clock was dinner time. My grandma had it ready on the table. We would get a knock on the side of our shared wall, and we knew that we all had to come over to my grandparents' side for dinner. But she's probably who I think of when I think about my childhood dinners. She always had a balanced meal. It always had some type of protein, your vegetable, your carbohydrates. But she took a lot of pride and careful attention to detail and dedication to making sure that we were having just a really good experience with food. Like her meatballs are some of my favorite meatballs even till this day. I often tell her, I'm like, Grandma, I need to sit down and just go through your recipes, because I don't know that we ever had the same thing more than one or two times. And we ate with her for years. So like, she just has, I don't even know, a library of recipes that I would love to just sit down and comb through one day, just for the memories that it would bring back.
And that, isn't that the case that, I think those of us who are in food, whether we farm it, whether we cook it, whether we do a podcast about it for that matter, food really does kind of become that portal. It's with COVID being what it's been. My parents finally got both shots, and we just spent the weekend, obviously Mother's Day, going up to my parents, and my mom made her pancakes. And, pancakes, you could very easily scoff at and go, well, pancakes, what about them? My mother does them in a way that it is a marriage of pancake and funnel cake, and I have not. In all of my time, and you know me, I spend enough time in the kitchen. I've not been able to replicate it as long as I've lived. It is maddening. And so those memories, those moments, you certainly, one, you want to cherish them, but two, you want to like curate them. You and I are in the e-learning field, so curation is key. Like, you want to make sure that sage knowledge doesn't go away when whether it's the employee or the person does, so that's awesome. I'm gonna guess here at my next question that growing up, greatest culinary influence was grandma.
For sure.
Absolute favorite thing that she taught you?
I think for me it was just to use like fresh foods. Growing up, my grandparents always gardened, so we would have fresh vegetables every summer. And even just your proteins too, but with us being able to supply the beef, but also just anything. It was the freshest of the fresh. She rarely ever cooked with anything that had preservatives in it that I can remember. So I think that has been my biggest takeaway from her, is looking for whole foods, and just trying to come up with healthy meal options.
That's awesome. That's awesome, because, there again, and this is not to wax romantic about the farm life, because the farm life is a hard life. Again, having just been up in Honesdale, there's a group, Northeast Farms. I'm going to mess up the name, and I don't have the business card with me, but if you're listening, I am going to be in touch. But it's a farm collective. So I go up to Honesdale, right? And I go in this place, and it's part restaurant. It's their first foray into this. But it's also like a mercantile. I start to look through. There's Nat's Craft Kombucha, or whatever she's calling it today, up in Honesdale. There's Wild for Salmon up in Honesdale. I'm like, oh my God. And so having that emphasis on freshness is the greatest thing. But then I turn and I see this shirt that says, no farms, no food. And it's this stark, I don't want to say cold reminder, but it really does kind of bring you back, like, this is why I buy local. You know, I'm not trying to hop up on a pedestal or, you know, placate to you, Lindsay, about this, mm-hmm. but like we buy local wherever and whenever possible because of the very reasons you mentioned before. And here's the thing, when the small farms go, the big farms go, whether people want to realize that or not, you know, when we stop supporting them, it's not just like, well, the big farms will just move in. There's going to be a breaking point. And so get out there, talk to your local farms, you know, stop by the produce stand. Like there's one, not, I don't know, 500 yards up the road from me. And literally you mm-hmm. take like change up with you to get the produce that you need for dinner. It's mm-hmm. crazy, crazy cheap. I shouldn't say cheap. I should say, you know, crazy cost effective. Like it's right. not, it's anyway, I digress. I could, you know, go off on a tangent. We're going to probably go there here in a minute, but you know, it's just so cool to hear that that was the lesson that she gave you. Of all the things it could have been, like a recipe or how to use an ingredient, it was just using fresh food. And so then that brings me to the next question of, so with this knowledge in mind, with your upbringing in mind, when was it that you looked at this and you said, well, now you have a little bit of an advantage. This was in your family, you know, for a while, but mm-hmm. like, when did you look at it and say, all right, I'm in. I want this to be my life. When was that?
So I would love to say it was like as soon as I came out of the womb, but it wasn't that way. Even though growing up, I remember playing in the barn, running barefoot outside, just being with the cows. It really wasn't until I was, oh gosh, let me think, probably 2017. So I would have been 27. I had been living up here in Bloomsburg and working full time and decided I wanted to go back to grad school for my master's in social work. Mm-hmm. So I moved back home, moved back in with my dad, and was attending University of Pennsylvania for my graduate degree and commuting from home. So in the evenings, I would help feed. On the weekends, I would help feed. My brother at the time was a herdsman for a local organic dairy farm. So I would help milk cows with him on the weekends. And it was during that 2 to 3 years of being back home for that master's program and really being hands-on with the animals and working side by side with my dad and my brother that I realized, like, this is what I want to do. And it was almost like, did I make a mistake in going back to grad school for mm-hmm. social work? Like, uh-huh. Is this what I'm meant to do? Or am I meant to follow more of an agricultural path? From that point in 2017 till now, it's just been a combination of trying to figure out how to make both avenues work, because I do have a passion for social work, but I obviously have a passion for agriculture.
Sure.
So I'm at the point now with my husband that we're making it work.
Nice. That's awesome. That's incredible. So, and I actually had no idea your master's was in social work and you were in my class. That's unbelievable.
Yes. As many people will tell you, I am a woman of many hats.
That is phenomenal. I mean, Jesus, you go from Wagyu to social work to multimedia. That is quite the transition, if I may be so bold. Simply awesome. And so 2017 to now, here you are with Greenwood Valley Wagyu, Greenwood Valley Wagyu on Facebook. And you are obviously spending time taking care of your pets, your babies, if we may be so bold, there again. And it's not just about raising them though. You've got to go out, you've got to sell the product. So just real quick kind of event plug. I know we were talking before the mics went live. Wednesdays and Saturdays are busy days for you.
Yes, they are. So Wednesdays and Saturdays, I set up at Lewisburg Farmers Market in Lewisburg. Mm-hmm. Wednesdays, I'm there from 9 to 1. Saturdays, I'm there 9 to 1. And shortly here, mid-May, and we will start rotating on Saturdays between Lewisburg and the Bloomsburg Fair Farmers Market. So we'll be even more local than just Lewisburg.
Awesome. awesome. And what you're selling is, you know, these wonderful, beautiful animals that give their very essence to us in the form of Wagyu beef. And, you know I did my Google search. I actually, I forget what the site was, but it was a very Japanese-influenced one, which kind of gave it a little credence, too. I didn't want some kind of crazy, you know, just Anglican nonsense. I wanted to really hear some good information about it. But I know that you're, once again, going to do a better job of explaining it to the lay people like myself. I've had Wagyu. This is like once, actually. Mm-hmm. And it was at, I want to say it was at a benefit dinner where one of the original Japanese Iron Chefs cooked, which was crazy. I mean, just madhouse. So like you're already, you're kind of like half in the moment enjoying it, but you're half in the moment that a celebrity is doing it. So unfortunately, my memory isn't as clear of it. So I want to start basic and just simply ask in two words, why Wagyu? Of all the types of beef you could raise, mm-hmm. why Wagyu?
So I want to say it comes down to probably two different answers. Mm-hmm. If you're looking at it from the stance of being a breed, mm-hmm. Wagyu themselves are, I'll caution myself in saying all of them, but most of the genetic lines are very docile. So they're easy to handle. Mm-hmm. They calve relatively easily, which is good for any farmer. Mm-hmm. So when you're looking at it that way, they're just an easy animal compared to other beef breeds to work with on an everyday basis. Okay. If you're looking at it from a consumer standpoint, Wagyu beef is going to be a higher end beef. Mm-hmm. To something like vehicles, it would be like the Ferrari of cars. Yeah. So it has a higher price point to it. In the U.S., a lot of farmers get into it as kind of like hobby farming. Mm-hmm. So there weren't many large producing farms for it, mm-hmm. especially in Pennsylvania. Okay. So that's kind of how my family and me and my husband started into it and the why behind it.
Got you. And so I know we talk, you know, I think even the layperson hears terms like marbling and all these things. And then they hear mm-hmm. Kobe and Wagyu. Give us the primer breakdown for everybody on why marbling matters. Here's one again that like you and I off mic, I would fumble through an answer and you'd like pat me on the head and go, okay, good answer. Here's your cookie. Go to your corner. Like I might get close. You obviously mm-hmm. have the master level answer. So why is marbling so significant?
Marbling is one of those hallmark traits of Wagyu. So when somebody hears Wagyu, sees Wagyu, the first thing they're going to notice is the marbling, which is like the white flecks of the intermuscular fat within the steak that you're looking at mm-hmm. Or you're eating. The marbling is what gives that cut of beef the tenderness, the extreme flavor. Mm-hmm. And with Wagyu, you're going to get a really nice, rich, buttery flavor, and it's a natural buttery flavor. So yeah. When you're cooking Wagyu, it's a beef that doesn't need a lot of doctoring. It doesn't need a lot of spices or seasoning. A little bit of salt and pepper goes a long way. Yeah. But it's that marbling that creates the experience for any consumer who is eating the Wagyu.
Now, I've heard it referred to as almost self-basting. Is that a misnomer or is that kind of accurate?
I would say that's pretty accurate.
Okay. You know, just because that intramuscular fat, obviously, you know, the outside is where you're going to get your sear. You're going to get that crust. But then inside, mm-hmm. as it comes to temp, it's going to release and it's going to go to the actual muscle and kind of lubricate and hydrate and keep mm-hmm. it nice on the inside. So to your point, very minimal salt and pepper. And that's pretty much yeah. the show. So
yeah.
I've heard you a couple times now, and I'm going to fully lay on my own sword here. Have I been mispronouncing it for years? Is it just Wagyu or Wagyu? Hard G or no G?
So you'll hear it a lot of different places. Mm-hmm. the way it technically is pronounced is Wagyu. Okay. You'll have some people call it Wagyu.
Okay.
But I think a lot of that comes down to just dialect and accent, depending on where you are in the U.S. especially. If you get a whole bunch of different producers in the same room, some from the West, some from Central U.S., they'll all have a little bit different pronunciation.
Got you. Okay. So long as you're not saying Wangu or something stupid like that, if you're close enough for jazz, you're in good shape.
Exactly.
All right. We'll take that.
We'll all know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So help me understand, because this is something I've honestly always wondered about, and I know it's a different breed, but beyond that, mm-hmm. my knowledge fails. Kobe and Wagyu, what is the difference between the two, and why can't we have American Kobe?
Okay, so Kobe is Wagyu. However, Wagyu is not Kobe. If you see it on a U.S. menu somewhere listed as Kobe beef, mm-hmm. that means it had to have been imported directly from the Kobe region of Japan.
Okay.
And even beyond that, it had to have been raised and harvested in the Kobe region of Japan and then imported to the U.S. So more times than not in the United States, you're going to see it listed maybe as Kobe style, mm-hmm. or it's going to be listed as Wagyu.
Okay.
Because the only way it can carry the name of Kobe is that it has to be that certified import from Japan.
Okay. So that's almost like how we get into wines, where, you know, a Rhone has to be from the Rhone region. Mm-hmm. You know, champagne has to be from France by French technique. And okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, but if you compared the meat quality side by side, are we similar? Are we identical? Are we not even close to one another?
I would say you're going to be similar.
Okay.
There's different marbling standards that are used. Some use the Japanese marbling, some use the U.S., some use the Australian. Mm-hmm. But no matter what, if you are going to be eating some of the top line American, you're going to be very close in marbling score to something that may be certified as Kobe.
Very cool. So with all this in mind, we have this beautiful, beautiful beef. I mean, Ferrari level beef. I think, honestly, Lindsay, I think that's what you should rename it. You know, forget Wagyu. This is Ferrari beef. Get in line. We're going Ferrari-ing. So we have this beef, but as we all know, with regards to beef, there are different cuts. Help me understand how the cuts from what we know from, say, the supermarket or from a farmer's market, maybe it's Angus beef, you know, and we get a T-bone, we get a ribeye, we get blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. What are the cuts from, say, like, you know, bottom end to top end quality-wise in mm-hmm. Wagyu? Are they different or are they the same across all cattle? You know, breed is irrelevant, the top cuts are the top cuts, or do some steaks kind of like flip-flop?
No. So I would say from beef breed to beef breed, you're mm-hmm. going to be pretty standard on what your prime cuts are. So like you're looking at filet mignon, you're looking at a mm-hmm. ribeye, mm-hmm. you're looking at New York strips. You might hear them, you know, termed differently, like a Delmonico,
right.
or like you said, the T-bone, that would just be the bone in. But otherwise, those are going to be your prime cuts straight across the board.
Gotcha.
And then you're going to have some of your secondary cuts, whether it's a chuck steak or ranch steak or top sirloin steak, flank, flat iron. Those are going to be pretty standard across the board as well.
Got you. And I mean, growing up in it, I have to ask you, if you had to name your top three cuts that you enjoy personally. And this mm-hmm. is always fun because everyone thinks like it's going to be filet. Like people are going to like jump out with that. A lot of times they don't, you know, a lot of times it makes it in. So I ask you, you know, what are your top three cuts that you like to work with best?
For me, I really like the ribeye. That would probably be my very first cut if I'm going from a prime cut. Then if I want something maybe that's a little bit more cost effective, mm-hmm. I would go with the chuck steak, especially with Wagyu, because the chuck steak, price point wise, is middle of the road, but you're not really going to be sacrificing the marbling, the flavor, the tenderness. It's going to give you a sample of all three of those hallmarks that is Wagyu beef.
Love it.
And then I would probably say I would go flank.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Because I was going to ask you about that anyway. That's my favorite steak in the world to work with. I love flank. I think flank's fun. How is Wagyu flank?
Very good.
Yeah.
I have a customer that has a standing order almost once a month of a couple of flanks. That's one of his favorites.
It's just, it's so, I don't even know how to describe it. My wife made this, you know, citrus grilled flank steak, you know, that, not Wagyu, obviously, once. And ever since, I've just been fascinated with the cut because it's this wonderful, it's brisket-esque in that it's like bigger and a little more muscular. And yet, it doesn't take the time and effort that brisket does, certainly. And it's tender like a New York strip if you nail it. Like it really gets in the pocket. Now, having mentioned brisket, I have to ask, what's Wagyu brisket like?
It's amazing.
I'm sure. Again, with the self-basting, like, shit, I spend so much time out on the grill just, you know, kind of like, you know, basting a little bit, spooning some jus on top, keeping it moving, like, this does the work itself. Am I correct?
It does, yes. And I always have to laugh because I have a lot of people who love smoking briskets.
Yeah.
And we sell a lot of whole briskets to, like, competition smokers, people who really enjoy that. But at the farmer's market, every now and then I'll get people to ask, and they all, okay, let me master my smoking abilities first before I invest in something and potentially mess it up. It can be finicky at times, but no, it is amazing. Mike and I, my husband, actually did smoked Wagyu brisket for our wedding, it was amazing. We had leftovers probably a week after our wedding, and we were so sad when we finished those.
Oh man, that's just, I mean, and I actually I finally bit the bullet. You know, actually, by way of my in-laws, speaking of, you know, husbands, wives, that kind of thing, they had just a little smoker stove. And I'm like, cool, that's like the perfect thing. I have this honking 7-burner grill and everything. But, you know, to smoke, it would be like, all right, I put a smoker pack on the grill and the smoke kind of gets close, right? This is devoted to it. So I've been dabbling in post oak and bourbon soaking the post oak and, I don't know. I think it might be high time to play with some Wagyu brisket. I'm not sure, but we might have to get in touch there, Lindsay. So, okay, so cool. All the cuts front to back, you know, kind of feel the same, but obviously, you know, again, all the models of a Nissan feel the same, and all the models of a Ferrari feel the same in that they have four wheels and they ride on the road.
Right.
Once you get past that, there's a world of difference among them. So I cannot wait to dabble in that a bit. I have to ask you, with all this in mind, so 2017 today, here you are running the show. Here you are knowing everything there is to know about it. Talk to me about the 5-year plan. Like, what does that turn into for you?
So for us, I have really enjoyed getting our brand, our name, our faces out to the public, whether it be through Facebook or through farmers markets. Mm-hmm. And I'll be honest, when I started our Facebook page, I figured nobody was going to know what Wagyu was. And boy, was I wrong. It blew up, felt like overnight, almost too quickly for what I was prepared for. But our 5-year plan would be to be able to do more farmers markets, to find little niche ways to meet with the public and meet their demands for beef. It's also to grow our own herd, whether that be through steers of our own or partnering further with my dad and my brother and helping them expand their farmette, their business.
Mm-hmm.
But no matter what way we look at it, we only see it growing.
That's awesome.
My husband would love to be able to farm full time. So if we can get to the point in the next 5 years where we're able to meet that goal, just with the number of head we have on our farm, that would be a dream come true for us.
Unreal. Unreal. I mean, I have no doubts that you're going to do it. I'm looking at your page now. Speaking of that, that drive, that spike, in the attention, Greenwood Valley Wagyu, for those interested, go check it out today. If you want more information, email greenwoodvalleywagyu, all one word, at gmail.com. Wow. And the logo is so sharp. Who made that?
Giant Marketing. It was actually a recommendation through a really good friend of mine.
Very nice. I'm just a little sad it wasn't you in Photoshop, but I'll let it go. It could have been. I'm scrolling up and down, and I mean, listen, folks listening, and I know if you're listening, you're into food. Just scroll this page and just look at the amazement. Like, that's unfair with the Rusty Rail Brewing. Like, here's beers in the back, beef in the front. I'm like, God damn it, Lindsay, what are you doing to me? This is what I love about farming in general, is that then there's these beautiful, happy, I think they're happy cows. I've never had a conversation, I'll be honest. Just trotting along, doing their thing, and they're gorgeous. They're gorgeous animals, and they're certainly, like, physically different. Big. I mean, just big. How much does each head weigh?
Oh my gosh. But by the time that they go to slaughter, I would say they're probably close to 1,600 pounds.
God almighty. God almighty. And just the care, you know, I know, and I don't want to go food philosophy or anything like that here, you know, because obviously we've had everybody from vegans on up to straight up carnivores. Nick Solaris from eater.com, you know, he's a carnivore by trade. And then Natalie Slater from Eat and Destroy, wrote a vegan dessert cookbook, which is, you know, amazing. So, like, we run the gamut. This is what I love about watching what you do. You just drop the word slaughter. And so, like, let's just touch on that, and then we'll get away from it. Because, you know, again, people are like, oh, it's so terrible. What about the animal? Listen, I would rather know my food and care for it the way that you folks do and feel good about that. You know, and I just think that's such a crucial part of it than these factory farms. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can, again, not to reference a vegan while we're talking about Wagyu beef, but, you know, there's a whole, like, meat is murder from Morrissey and all that, you know. They go a little hard to the side, but if you watch it about factory farming, they're right. They're treated like shit. They're stalled off. They're not allowed to do anything. They're just there for the duration. These cows, and I'm saying that right, not cattle, cows. What's the preferred term?
Either or. I used interchangeably. Yeah.
All right, cool. Like, they look loved. Like, I'm not lying. I'm not trying to be corny about this. They look like they're happy.
For sure. And I always tell people, you mentioned it earlier, and it's true, like, they are my babies.
Yeah.
And this isn't just the social worker and me talking, but every single one has such a unique personality that from the time that they are weaned from mom until the time that they are either used to benefit us genetically or used for harvest for beef.
Yeah.
You get to see their personalities come out. Uh-huh. And it's almost therapeutic in a way to work with them.
Yeah.
Just on a daily basis, and to see them grow and to connect with them all on different levels, that I think being a small producer, we can bring that relationship that some of, like, the larger mass producing farms are missing.
Yeah.
So the animals are extremely well cared for, from feeding to just comfort to just the way that they're handled.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's so important. I think that's where people will, as a knee-jerk reaction, get uncomfortable with it. you know, mm-hmm. because it's not your little styrofoam container that's been heat sealed with plastic wrap, and you pick mm-hmm. it up and you scan it at the register. Mm-hmm. There's more to it than that. And like, you have to, I don't know. I think being an omnivore or carnivore should be an informed decision. You should, you have to be aware of this. You should have to listen to this interview for that matter. There you go. There you go. We're marketing the podcast as we go. But just such a cool point, and so really nice to see. And again, it makes me want to, you know, buy from you, because like, look at how they're cared for. Anyway, we're not going to convert anybody here. We're not trying to stop your whining, take your quinoa, go home. It's fine. I'm not trying to do that, but just such a cool thing to see when you think about, you know, really ultimately what's going on here. So, God, that's first of all, awesome 5-year plan. Awesome just plan overall. And I'm sure it's going to work out for you, because you're amazing. You know what you're doing. You have such a love for these animals and for the craft itself. I see nothing but success. Why? Well, how possibly could we? So again, when they're looking to track you down, Wednesday currently at the Lewisburg Farmers Markets, and then Saturdays you're alternating between the Bloomsburg Farmers Market down at the fairgrounds and then the Lewisburg Farmers Market there again.
Yes, and cool. I'll add to, I'm always monitoring our Facebook page. So if you can't make it to a market day, just send us a message. I have met people all over the community to exchange beef with them. I have even delivered to people's houses on occasion. So if you want something, don't let not being able to get to the market stop you.
Listen to that, people. I mean, it's Wagyu on demand. It's WOD. That's what you want in your life. You want some Wagyu on demand. Why wouldn't you? And speaking of Wagyu on demand, not necessarily on demand, but by order, they can also check your beef out at Turkey Hill Brewing, correct?
Yes. Yeah. We actually just dropped off an order of short ribs. I don't know how they're going to be preparing them, but I know that they're going to be hitting the menu soon.
Very nice.
And Mike and I might need to have a date night to go take a taste of them.
That sounds fantastic. Hey, I'll babysit the kids if you want. I'll come out there and I'll bring some grass.
They would love it.
All right. So that's the mains, starters, mains. We got to touch on afters. I got to ask you some funky stuff just because it's what we do here. I typically ask, I'm standing in your kitchen, and we can say standing in your kitchen or working in your barn. What music are we listening to?
We are listening to a mix of stuff. And it's funny that you say that, because whenever I feed, either in the mornings or at night, I'm always playing shuffle on my phone for the girls, singing along to them all. But it's primarily going to be a mix of country music. You might get a little Taylor Swift. You might get a little Luke Combs. You're definitely going to get some Garth Brooks.
Nice.
Some George Strait. So
yeah.
I cover pretty much a wide range of country music.
There you go. That is a wide range. I like that. We go from Taylor Swift all the way down to George Strait. That's a gamut right there. All right. Hypothetical question here for you. You're going to be stranded on a deserted island. Imagine it, if you will. You can only bring 3 foods or food type items with you. Inexhaustible supplies, but only 3 things. What would they be and why?
So definitely mint chocolate chip ice cream.
That's awesome.
Absolute favorite food.
Nice.
100% coffee, because that runs through my veins.
Love it.
I'm pretty sure I would be dead upon arrival without it. My third, I'm going to have to say, this is a hard one, but it's going to have to be beef.
Love it.
Protein in somehow.
Love it. Not only did she raise it and sell it, damn it, she's taking it with her to the island if it's the only 3 things she can have. So, hell yeah. Absolutely. There was a coffee table book. Famous New York photographer Melanie Denea did it, called My Last Supper. Have you heard of it by chance?
It sounds vaguely familiar.
I will send you the link off air. It is one of my favorite books. She did a follow-up to it called The Next Course, and in each volume, there's 50 world-famous chefs, and they're asked 5 questions, and they each got 1 picture in it. And the 5 questions revolve around your ticket is getting punched tomorrow. What are you enjoying today? And so I ask you, Lindsay, what's your last meal? What are you eating? What are you drinking? Who's there? What music is playing?
So if today was my last meal, it would be 100% some type of barbecue beef. I would say brisket. I love like the home cooked, almost southern style meal. So probably some type of pulled brisket with barbecue, nice. Mash for sure. Green beans.
Yes.
We would have probably apple crisp for dessert. My grandma's apple crisp to be exact.
Uh-huh.
And we would definitely have some beer. My favorite is called Gooder Wooder from a small brewery back where I'm from called J.J. Paddington's.
Nice.
It was our beer at our wedding. And it would be all my friends and family around the table just laughing, telling stories, and spending good old quality time together.
I love that. And that sounds, it's so funny how the answers to that question paint a picture of the person. And I mean, you know, I knew you from class. I kind of knew what you did, but that answer right there paints the whole picture. You know, it fills in the gaps because I think that's, you know, you really want to get to know where someone's at. Ask them that question. Now, most likely if they're a stranger, they'll run. But if they don't run, you're going to know more about them by the end of the conversation for sure. So, Lindsay, one last question, the final question, the most basic but the most complex. What is food to you in a single word?
Oh, goodness. Let me think about this for a second. Food to me in a single word.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go with nourishment.
Nourishment. I love it. Now, tell me a little bit more about that. Just the physical nourishment?
No, I think it goes much more beyond that.
Love it.
When I think food, not only obviously are you nourishing your body with the different nutrients that are part of the food, but I also think of it as an opportunity to share something with people around the table. So you're also nourishing your relationship, emotionally, mentally, and just really having connection with everyone.
I love it. It's such a simple question. And yet, you know, to say that, to nourish isn't just nourishing body, it's nourishing soul, it's nourishing mind, nourishing all of it. So, and Lindsay, thank you for nourishing our knowledge of this ever elusive Ferrari of beef that is the Wagyu. Just to run back down the schedule, break out your pens and pencils and paper if you're listening, kids. Wednesday, Lewisburg Farmers Market. Saturday, alternating between Bloomsburg and Lewisburg Farmers Market. You can find Lindsay and more specifically Greenwood Valley Wagyu on the Facebook, the Book of Face. And you can also, coming up very soon, find their short ribs on the menu at Turkey Hill Brewing Company. Anything that I missed?
I don't think so. I'm pretty sure you covered it all.
Fantastic. Lindsay, always a pleasure. Great catching up with you, and only the best to you and yours.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this has been episode number 164 of the Course Grind Podcast. With me again this evening, the cow mom, Lindsay Miller, and Greenwood Valley Wagyu. Our producer, as always this evening, has been the lovely, voluptuous Johnny Leland Robinson, a.k.a. the Reverend Johnny Lemuria. Be sure to check out all his social happenings all across the media social, as well as the reboot of his Johnny Lemuria show. Next episode is going to be part 2 of a local check back in. You will not want to miss it. Stay tuned.